Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Adam Ragusea in for Anthony Brooks.
In 1841, Abraham Lincoln descended into a deep depression. The future president was 32 years old at the time. It was his second debilitating depressive episode, and he'd have a third in the midst of the Civil War. But in 1841, the effects of Lincoln's depression were already so marked, a friend noted, "The doctors say he is within an inch of being a perfect lunatic for life." But in the eyes of Dr. Nasir Gami, it's this near-perfect lunacy that made Lincoln a magnificent leader during the crisis of the Civil War.
Well, I specialize in bipolar disorder, so I treat a lot of people with mania and depression. And I noticed that a lot of great leaders appear to have a lot of the same symptoms that my patients have. And I noticed that historians either didn't note this or denied it. So I decided to try to set the record straight.
Gami is the director of the Mood Disorders Program at Tufts University. In his new book, A First-Rate Madness, Uncovering the Links Between Leadership and Mental Illness, he makes a provocative claim. The best crisis leaders, Gami writes, are either mentally ill or mentally abnormal. The worst crisis leaders are mentally healthy. The statement has won Gami as many critics as it has admirers. So I put some of those criticisms to him in a conversation that began with his analysis of another wartime leader, Winston Churchill.
I would say to the House, as I said to those who have joined the government, I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. We have before us an ordeal of the most grievous kind. We have before us many, many long months of struggle and of suffering.
These are excerpts from a speech Churchill made to the British Parliament in 1940. By that time, he'd already privately, but frequently referred to the black dog of his own depression, ever at his side.
So Churchill's depression's been very well proven. He also had high levels of energy when he wasn't depressed, which I would say sound like manic symptoms as one's temperament. He would stay up till 3 in the morning, do most of his work at night, be very talkative, very bombastic. And had many ideas. Roosevelt once said of Churchill that he had 100 ideas a day, 4 of which were brilliant, which is a good example of flight of ideas, I think, as a manic symptom. So his mental illness is pretty well established, but I wanted to point out how depression might be related to realism in the case of Churchill, because it's so clear that in the 1930s he was so realistic about the Nazi threat long before others. And yet, what was interesting was that Stanley Baldwin and Neville Chamberlain, who were the leaders of the Conservative Party at the time, were such sane, supremely sane men. They were upright. They were reliable. They had been very successful in their political and business careers, whereas Churchill seemed like a temperamental, bombastic, quirky weirdo to most people at the time. And for a decade, you saw so clearly how the sane, impressive people couldn't see what was happening, whereas the temperamental backbencher who was seen as unpredictable could tell what was happening.
Chamberlain had followed a policy of appeasement with Hitler. Churchill had taken Chamberlain's place as British Prime Minister by the time he gave this speech before a joint session of Congress in 1942.
Twice in a single generation, the catastrophe of World War has fallen upon us. If we had kept together after the last war, if we had taken common measures for our safety, this renewal of the curse need never have fallen upon us.
It seems remarkable to me because in the case of Baldwin and Chamberlain, I mean, between the end of World War I and the start of World War II, it's a mere 21 years, right? 1918 to 1939. So it's hard to ascribe these major acts by leaders down to one thing, like down to their mental health.
I'm not reducing it to that one thing. I'm saying we shouldn't ignore it, as all previous historians have, or most of them. History and psychology, or history and psychiatry, have a lot in common, actually. And they both engage in trying to understand the motives of other people. And if critics want to say we shouldn't allow psychiatric ideas to be applied to history, then they have to explain why we shouldn't interpret the motives of anybody in history in any way. And history is not science, you're right. But sciences also involve interpretations, especially psychological and psychiatric sciences. And we're still able to engage in some scientific work. We're able to do some testing, some quantitative testing, for instance. So I would just say to critics like that, why should we assume that all of history, everything is psychiatrically normal and anyone is allowed to make common sense into intuitive judgments, whereas psychiatric judgments are forbidden?
So Nasir Gami claims depression made Winston Churchill more realistic. It allowed him to see Hitler's true motives. Interesting, because Churchill never claimed any empathy towards the Nazi leader, whereas Gami says two other leaders of nonviolent movements derived their power from their empathy: Martin Luther King Jr. and Mahatma Gandhi, speaking here in 1931.
I regard myself as a soldier, though a soldier of peace. I must ask you to believe me when I say that I have never made a statement of this description, that the masses of India, if it became necessary, would resort to violence. I regard myself as incapable in my lucid moments of making a statement of this character.
They both made suicide attempts in adolescence. They each had a serious depressive episode that meets the clinical definition of depression: changes in sleep, appetite, interest, and energy with persistent sad mood for weeks on end. That's the official definition. They had that in the middle of their lives, around age 30 for King, a little later for Gandhi. They each met that same definition just before they were killed. Martin Luther King, for instance, was advised by some of his aides to get psychiatric treatment towards the end of his life. Gandhi's doctors told him when he had his severe depression in the middle of his life and was physically ill and in the hospital, there was nothing physically wrong with him, it was mental. They didn't accept it, but the fact that others noticed this is also relevant. So it's not just symptoms, it's genetics, course, and treatment. And you certainly can't explain all that based on what's going on in one's environment.
So how does that lead to them being more empathetic?
The research shows, in comparison of patients who have depression with patients with other psychiatric conditions, with normal subjects, with rating scales of empathy, that those with depression have score much higher on those rating scales of empathy than the other groups.
I guess what I'm wondering is that you state very clearly in your book that you believe that in part it is these mental illnesses that made these men great leaders in times of crisis. I mean, you are drawing a line of causation between their illness and their effectiveness in history. Mm-hmm. So in the case of King and Gandhi, both as great leaders of enormous nonviolent movements, what was it about their depressive natures that made them great leaders?
Dr. King is a really incredible individual, not for the simplistic iconic reasons that people think of it now, but actually because of how nuanced he was in his emotional life, I think. When he took the lead, he immediately sought to make the desegregation process happen through nonviolent methods. Now, the reason he did this, I think, was because of his intuitive emotional sense that one should be empathic towards others. I call it a politics of radical empathy. That's what I think his nonviolent movement is. So he could have said, look, we're just going to try to defeat the enemy. The enemy is white racism, and we're going to try to get laws passed that are going to give us voting rights and civil rights. He achieved those goals, but at the same time, he wanted to convince the white racists that they were wrong. He didn't want to defeat them. He didn't want to crush them under his boots. He wanted to have them come to the realization themselves over time that racism was wrong. So he and his colleagues often use the analogy, and I document this in a personal interview with Dr. Alvin Poussant, that the civil rights movement was a cure for the disease of racism. It was a psychiatric metaphor that they were using. And King often used psychiatric metaphors in his sermons. He often talked about schizophrenic personalities and depression and neurosis. He used these terms. And he thought that the civil rights movement would be a way to make white people not be racist, and racism was viewed as a psychological problem, as almost a mental disease.
We hear this theme in a speech King gave at the National Cathedral in 1968, just 4 days before he was assassinated.
It is an unhappy truth that racism is a way of life for the vast majority of white Americans.
Gami's critics point out that Dr. Alvin Poussant, whom Gami quotes, was not only a civil rights ally of King, but a professor of psychiatry as well. And Poussant does not believe depression played a major role in King's behavior as a leader.
Spoken and unspoken, acknowledged and denied, subtle, and sometimes not so subtle, the disease of racism permeates and poisons a whole body politic. And I can see nothing more urgent than for America to work passionately and unrelentingly to get rid of the disease of racism.
The problem here, I think, is that you have picked very high-profile leaders who were, in a way, triumphant. But, of course, the flip side must be true, that there are and have been many leaders who've shown the same forms of mental illness who are catastrophic for their people.
Yes, and one of the points that I'm making is not just the presence of mental illness in a generic way. I'm not saying if you're schizophrenic and you're psychotic, you're going to be a great leader. I'm not saying any mental illness. I'm saying these specific kinds, mania and depression, can be helpful. So the answer is what I write about in First Rate Madness, I call it the Goldilocks principle. A little bit of these symptoms to a moderate amount is helpful. A severe amount is not helpful. That would answer your question. And none of these symptoms at all, being completely mentally healthy, is also not helpful. And I'm not saying in general, for non-crisis leadership, times of peace and prosperity, being mentally healthy is very helpful. The past predicts the future. Things can go smoothly when you have an average person running things the same way. But when there's a crisis and one needs to think completely differently, it seems to that being somewhat less creative and less realistic and less resilient and less empathic is not helpful. And mental health is associated with having less of those traits than people with mania and depression.
I mean, this is exactly the thing that you, in part, criticized Barack Obama for mm-hmm. for being no drama. But looking at the state of Washington today, lots of people might say that's exactly what we need because there's too much drama there already that is so disconnected from my reality.
Different kinds of leadership are needed for different circumstances. I don't criticize President Obama. I'm just commenting on the fact that he has set himself up as a no-drama Obama, supremely sane, mentally well-adjusted, in quotes to his own phrase, person. Whereas Dr. King said that we should be looking for the creatively maladjusted as opposed to the well-adjusted in one of his sermons.
I mean, forgive me for pressing you on this, but as you said, your book has been out long enough and it's raised enough questions that I feel like we should pursue some of them. And one of them is that in the mentally healthy category, for example, you put George W. Bush, Richard Nixon, Barack Obama. Lots of people have come back and said, Richard Nixon, paranoid. George W. Bush, history of alcohol, substance abuse. Armchair psychiatrists might even put George W. Bush in the category of unrealistic, mildly narcissistic, and deciding to create a reality in Afghanistan and Iraq that couldn't possibly be what was there. I mean, the whole weapons of mass destruction thing. So this gets back down to the issue that people feel that you've sort of been cherry-picking symptoms and applying them to leaders in a way that's most convenient for your thesis about great leadership.
In these cases, I think, for example, with George W. Bush, I write in A First Rate Madness everything that you just said about him being out of touch with reality, increasingly so in relation to 9/11 and the invasion of Iraq and weapons of mass destruction. But the scientific research shows that that's much more likely to happen in mentally healthy people than mentally ill, because in the mentally healthy, there is what's called mild positive illusion. That's why the depressed people are more realistic than the healthy people. Those who are not depressed at all, we think about things more optimistically than reality is. If you go too far with this, you obviously can get out of touch enough that it can be harmful. And Lord David Owen, who's a British foreign minister and neurologist, has called this the hubris syndrome in relation to Bush and Blair. And what I think is interesting is that since Bush and Blair were mentally healthy before they went to power, that one possibility is that once they got to power, this mild amount of positive illusion expanded, partly because of the influence of power. One has yes men who don't give you negative information. One gets so much positive feedback about one's ability and power and prestige that one stops listening to others. And I'm not coming at this with any prior agenda personally about any of these people. I'm not a fan of Nixon, but I happen to find that there's no evidence of this in his background, so I'm not going to call him mentally ill. And to call him mentally ill because he's paranoid is, again, that psychoanalytic speculation that's very unscientific that I'm not doing. So it seems difficult here. People seem to be unhappy when I use scientific methods to diagnose mental illness in some people, and then they're unhappy when I use scientific methods to say there's no mental illness in other people.
See, I wonder where this all leaves us as those who are being led, those of us who are not the leaders, because it just makes a lot of sense to me that what we desire is the calm, competent, supremely sane leader.
I think that the takeaway point for the general population, if people accept some of my notions here, is that we should not be selecting our leaders in times of crisis based on who we would like to have a beer with. If you do it on the beer test, you're going to get George W. Bush and Tony Blair, who literally passed a beer test when he got his first labor election by having beer and watching soccer with some labor politicians. You wouldn't want to have a beer with Abraham Lincoln. You probably wouldn't be able to have dinner with Winston Churchill because he was so bombastic and difficult. But when the crisis came, those are the people that you want in a position of power.
It's so difficult because we almost never get a chance to choose our leaders in the midst of a crisis. The crisis happens to the leader. It happens to the nation.
It's true that usually when a crisis happens, we have the leaders from the times of peace and prosperity before the crisis, and so we're always set up in a way for failure. But we do sometimes choose leaders in times of crisis. Maybe a good example would be Franklin Roosevelt. Herbert Hoover had been president, and the crisis had happened. The banks were failing, and the Depression was really out of control. And people chose a disabled, paralyzed man. He had manic symptoms. We call it hyperthymic temperament. Again, I hope people look at a first-rate manist to make their own judgments about the evidence that I provide there for it. That hyperthymic temperament's been shown to enhance people's response to trauma in psychological studies. People are more resilient. They don't get post-traumatic stress symptoms. They're not anxious. They're responsive. They even get stronger.
Now, some might call that just good old-fashioned American optimism or very savvy politicking, which Roosevelt was famous for. Take, for example, how he drafted both humor and his dog in response to Republican attacks in 1944.
These Republican leaders have not been content with attacks on me or on my wife or on my sons. No, not content with that. They now include my little dog, Fowler.
Is it possible that you are romanticizing mental illness?
I've treated bipolar disorder for 20 years. I've had a number of patients commit suicide. I don't romanticize this at all. Just in the last few weeks since this book has been published, I've received many, many emails that were positive from many people telling me that they never thought that they would ever be willing to consider psychiatric treatment. But now that someone like me is willing to consider these positive aspects of their condition as well, they're willing to get treatment for the clear negative aspects. They just want respect. And they're not getting that when people view these illnesses as purely negative, evil things.
Well, Nasir Ghami, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Meghna. Nice to be here with you.
Nasir Ghami is the director of the Mood Disorders Program at Tufts University and author of A First-Rate Madness, Uncovering the Links Between Leadership and Mental Illness. You can find an excerpt of his book and do let us know what you think at radioboston.org.
Coming up next, breaking news out of the Archdiocese of Boston. Stay with us. I'm Adam Ragusea.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.